from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. To mark the 25th anniversary of REM's landmark album, Automatic for the People, we asked you to name your favorite REM songs. Here's Wilson from Dahlonega.
My favorite REM song the whole time is What Frequency Can It? Mainly because of the absolutely bizarre backstory to it. It was all about Dan Rather's assault in the 80s. Two men assaulted Dan Rather, and one of them kept on screaming over and over, "What's the frequency, Kenneth? What's the frequency, Kenneth?"
We talked to REM bassist Mike Mills later this hour, but we want to know, what albums stand the test of time for you? What album, not a song, can you still listen to years later? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post your comments on Facebook or on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments or musical choices on the show. Comedian Jim Gaffigan has appeared in That 70s Show, Fargo, Bob's Burgers, and of course, Law and Order, but he may be best known for his stand-up specials and two seasons of The Jim Gaffigan Show. Here's a scene from that show. Jim is in court.
Ladies and gentlemen, I realize we live in a politically correct era, and that's a good thing. We should always strive to be more respectful. I believe in equality for everyone. I consider my wife my equal. I mean, when we rent a car, I won't let her drive, but that's not sexism. I just don't want to die.
Jim Gaffigan is in Atlanta this weekend for a live show. When I talked to him 2 weeks ago, he told me there's an argument for comedians not to talk about the news. How do you, as a comedian, when your job is to sort of stay on top of really current events and stay relevant in a way that most professionals don't have to be, how do you make that sustain over years?
Well, I mean, you know, there are topical comedians, but it's, and there's, you know, people that deal with, you know, politics or, you know, things that are tabloid topics. But there's also, I think, a desire for a break from it. I mean, I think particularly in this day and age that we live in, there is a desire to, you know, not talk about the political firestorm that we're in, just because, not just because we're inundated with it on a daily basis, but because there's a fatigue on the emotional tax that one can sustain. I mean, I find that, particularly since the election, you bring up the topic of the president or the divide that exists in our country, and people just start looking at the ceiling, you know? So I feel like my type of comedy is kind of a, unintentionally, but I think it's kind of a break from it.
Do you think it's harder to get people to laugh about it, that you want to avoid it because they want an escape, or it's just people are not ready to laugh about it?
Well, I mean, you don't want to be, I guess people are definitely always ready. You can make anything funny, but I think that we're in the middle of it, and there are a lot of outlets that, you know, whether it be late night shows or, you know, just social media hammering the topics. But I think there's something about it, just a safe place to not talk about it. You know, it's kind of, even, you know, in family settings, people have different opinions on it. So it's like, it's nice to just maybe come and hear me talk about how fat and lazy I am.
Well, you're going to be performing in Atlanta, which is, of course, the South. I wanted to play a couple clips of you in terms of things that you've said about Southerners before. Here's a clip from your comedy special, Obsessed.
People in the South are nicer, but they're slower, right? And I don't mean intelligence-wise. They just move slower. It's like, hey, your house is on fire. All right. I'll get to that. But first I need to drink me some sweet tea. Then I'll deal with that pesky house, man. And I figured it out. It's the biscuits and gravy.
Do you eat biscuits and gravy? Is that where the...
Oh, most definitely.
I mean, it sounds like that joke comes from the way you felt after you ate biscuits and gravy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I, you know, I remember going to Atlanta and performing at the Punchline Comedy Club. I mean, this was 10 years ago. And I would do morning press, and then I would go back to the hotel and have the breakfast buffet and having biscuits and gravy. And it was a little bit like being given a sedative. So it was, you know, biscuits and gravy. I mean, sure, you can kind of get them, you know, in other parts of the country. But, like, you know, in the Southeast, that's where, you know, that's the home of biscuits and gravy. I'm still waiting for the diet biscuits and gravy.
Good luck. It's not going to happen in Atlanta. Let's hear the other end of that joke from Obsessed.
The South will never rise again because they don't have the energy. Because most of their dishes involve paper mache. They're essentially eating pinatas down there. That's why they talk that way. Because after you eat biscuits and gravy, you can't be expected to say you and all.
Good biscuits and gravy, y'all.
How do you change your act or your jokes, or do you, as you move around the country?
I don't. I'm always writing, but the hour that I'm working on is, you know, it's always new when I come to a city. I space out performances that way. But the hour doesn't change. It's like maybe the, it's just the conversation might change. You know, stand up is very much a conversation. So how people respond to it might be different. So like that joke, you know, has just a different meaning for someone that lives in the South than say someone that lives in Northern California. They might view it much more as a cliche, whereas someone in the South might be like, yeah, that's right, the last time I had biscuits and gravy, I was pretty much a waste. Or people would know you would have biscuits and gravy on, like, say, a weekend after church rather than, like, before you go to work.
Oh, yeah, that would be a little heavy for work. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jim Gaffigan. He comes to Atlanta this weekend for a live show. I wonder how you feel about the kind of, in some ways, new role comedians are playing in politics these days. I mean, there are actually comedians at this point that are being discussed in political reporting and in journalism and by politicians. They become part of our discussion. Jimmy Kimmel is now part of the political math when you talk about healthcare. Would you consider that to be a good thing or not?
Well, I think comedians have you know, a responsibility to the truth, you know, and so I don't see there's anything negative about it. I think that particularly, you know, that's something that is personal and important to Jimmy Kimmel. So I think it's, as long as it's in, motivated by the right intention, I don't think there's any boundary. You know, like, I don't think there's anything unusual with, I mean, Mark Twain was very much, commenting and probably influencing politics of his day. So it's, I think it's all good, you know, it's like the dialogue. But again, it's context. So it's like Jimmy Kimmel talking about politics is great. But, you know, I think that, you know, when people come to my shows, they, you know, I think there's kind of like, all right, let's take a break from this. Like, we all, you know, I'm not being naive, or there's not a bubble that where it doesn't exist. It's, I might make a reference or two, like, we live in these tense times, but I'm not gonna, you know, relitigate, you know, the news that we've all been dealing with daily.
How difficult was that when you were first starting out to stick to that principle that I'm gonna be the one that doesn't fill my act with, you know, cursing or sexual jokes?
Well, you know, to be honest, I found my, you know, I mean, I am from a small town in Indiana. So I think the comedians kind of get a lot of credit or criticism for doing the type of act they would do anyway. And when I started, I tried to find my voice, tried on different kind of, tones and, personalities, I guess. And you end up just kind of being the one you're going to be at the beginning. So, for me, it's not that I don't find politics fascinating or that I don't, enjoy an off-color joke. It's just that I think I'm from a small town in Indiana. So, like, if I was talking in front of a large group, I would be less likely to curse, or it would be, from my town, it would be like unnecessary. Like, you might curse if you stub your toe, but like, if you're talking about, say, muffins, it's not necessary to curse. So it's just kind of like, what makes sense for my persona.
So, I mean, as you travel around the country, I mean, sometimes comedians see more cities than truck drivers do. And I wonder if you actually get time to get a sense of the nation, kind of as the body politic. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you get the sense as you travel around that the nation is as divided as all of our polls say we are.
I mean, well, from my personal experience, I would say there was a time when, so I've toured right before the election, and my friend who opened the show he was part of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and he had jokes discussing the political, discussing Hillary and Bernie and Trump, and those jokes went over great, with maybe they didn't kill in Knoxville, but like, essentially what happened, from what I can see, is that people after the election, there is this, and I know I'm kind of repeating myself, but like, generally people, like, you bring up the word Trump or you bring up politics, and it's I can only describe it as people start looking at the ceiling. Like, they, no matter what side you're on, there is this fatigue. Now, I don't know where this is in the Kubler-Ross kind of grieving stage, or,
five stages of grieving.
I'm very confident. Yeah, I'm very confident that, like, we're going to get through this as a country, but I do think that there's been a change from how people discuss and receive discussions on politics.
That's comedian Jim Gaffigan. He performs this Saturday night at 8 o'clock at Phillips Arena in Atlanta. To get details and more from Jim's past performances, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, a conversation with a children's book author who wrote his first book while working on an automobile factory line. First, though, a conversation with REM bassist Mike Mills. This is On Second Thought.
After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang out. After midnight, we're gonna chug, lug, and shout.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 25 years ago, this song hit the radio.
If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe there's nothing up his sleeve, and nothing is cool.
That is Man on the Moon by Athens' own REM. It was one of many hit tracks from the group's 8th studio album, Automatic for the People. That record hit number 2 on the Billboard 200 charts in 1992 and was certified 4 times platinum in the U.S. Automatic for the People is getting a 25-year anniversary re-release out on November 10th. And with me to talk about the record is REM's bass player and sometimes piano player, Mike Mills. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello. And I wonder, how often, if ever, do you listen back to this old stuff?
Not really that often. It's hard for me to listen for pleasure because I'm too hypercritical about things. But obviously, because of the attention around this one, I've heard it a good bit lately, and it sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Do you listen to tracks ever and think, oh, I wish I could get back in the studio and fix whatever?
Oh yes, there's almost always something that you might have done differently. But that's the trouble with making records. You have to know when to just let it go and cut it off.
Well, that would be my next question, is how do you know that? How do you know when to stop tinkering?
Well, these things called deadlines are really useful when you have those things. You know, it depends on your budget, your deadline, but you also... when you're first starting off, you tend to have more of a budget and more of a deadline. And then if you become more successful, there can be a tendency to over-examine. So you just have to have a built-in editing. Bill Berry was always very good at that for us, was knowing when to stop the song and when to stop working on it and say, that's enough, let's go.
I want to play as many of the tracks from this album as I possibly can. So let's go to one of the slower cuts. This is Everybody Hurts.
Don't let yourself go. As everybody cries, everybody hurts sometimes.
You know, you guys had been a band for a long time by the time this album came out, and I wonder if you had any sense of what you had on your hands, that this one was going to be sort of a smash hit. Did you suspect it?
I don't believe we did. Really, ever since the first album, we were always expecting that the next one would be the one that everyone hated. That's why we called the second one Reckoning, because we figured that was going to be our day of reckoning and everything is going to come crashing down. We knew it was a good record. We knew we liked the songs. But you never know what they're going to do once you turn them loose. But we felt pretty good about it.
How much do you think that album was a product of its time, of the 1990s? Or in other words, would it sound really different if you made that today?
Oh, I'm sure it would sound completely different today. But that's such an infinitely variable question. I mean, would we still be 30 years old, or would this be the later version of us making this and would be using today's technology and trying to get it on today's radio? I mean, there's just any number of variables that can change that. But the answer really is that every record is a time capsule. Every record is an encapsulation of what the band was and what they were thinking and what they were feeling at that moment, which is why they're so cool, because they're pretty much self-contained.
So let's hear another one that became a hit. A lot of the songs on this album did. This is Night Swimming.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. The photograph on the dashboard taken years ago. Turned around back so the windshield shows.
That you're on piano in that particular track. You know, I heard a recording of this in which the entire audience was singing every word along with the band. And I wonder, the first time that happened, when you played a concert and the whole audience knew your music, what is that like?
Well, it means you've connected. The good songs are the ones that resonate with people, and they care enough to listen to it enough to learn the words. Playing that song live, I was too busy concentrating on not screwing up the piano to hear anybody singing. But generally, yeah, when the audience is shouting along, you know you've reached them, and it just elevates. You know, if you're in a live concert and you hear everybody singing, it elevates the concert. It makes you feel like they're on your side, and whatever you're going to do is probably going to work.
You have stayed in Athens. How come?
Well, because I got to leave it a lot. You know, that's part of it. But at the same time, there's no better place to come back to. It is home and has been for many, many years. When you've been on the road and you've been in big cities and just depending on your makeup. But for me personally, it was really nice to be able to come back here and decompress. I love this town. I always have. And I really enjoy being here. So why not come back?
Well, do you think of REM's music as being Southern?
Well, yes. I mean, by it's de facto, if nothing else. I mean, the fact is we all were in the South, and, you know, I think I'm the only one that was here my entire life, but we were definitely felt Southern. You know, we just enjoyed presenting being Southern in a way that most people didn't think of as Southern. A lot of the things about the South get badly stereotyped, and you know, people tend to focus on some of the more negative aspects of it. So we were really happy to present Southernness and Southerners as something, you know, unique and interesting and intelligent, to be honest with you. So that was a really fun way to show the world that the South was not just what you thought it was.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with REM bassist Mike Mills. We're talking about the classic album Automatic for the People, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Do people recognize you? Do they come up to you and start singing their favorite REM song to you?
Oh, I hope not. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, sure, you get recognized. Depends on where you are. Depends on context. I mean, most of the time I walk around completely anonymous. But, you know, if I'm at a rock show, there'll be music fans there. But so I'm more likely to be recognized in a situation like that. But generally, it's, you know, it's pretty free and easy.
And is that a positive or a negative that, you know, you're not as recognizable, say, as Michael Stipe's face?
Oh, I'd say it's definitely a positive. You know, it's good to be in a famous band without being particularly famous. You kind of get the best of both worlds.
So let me ask you some more esoteric questions. And let me start with, like, the role of a bassist in a band. There's one thing about playing a solo bass or being a soloist or whatever it is. But what is the purpose? What is a priority for a bass player when they're playing in a band?
Well, that's a good question. It of course varies, obviously, from band to band. I think generally the first requirement is that you play well with the drummer. You know, whether you're in just a 2-4 stomp country band or whether you're in a, you know, prog jazz band, you still have to be able to link up with the drummer. So I think that's the first priority. In our band, I was really lucky that Peter's style of playing allowed me a lot of freedom, you know, both to create melody and to also sort of dictate what the chords were, because a lot of Peter's open chording allowed me to establish with the root note, if I ever played it, which I didn't very often, but I could often determine what the chord was. So that's really fun. So generally the bass player's got to, you know, depending on what other instruments there are in the band, he's got to hold down the low end, literally the bottom end of the spectrum, and just keep things moving with the drummer.
And who do you look to as some of your sort of bass mentors, your idols when it comes to bass playing?
Well, I looked for, I think, different things in a lot of bass players. Certainly, you know, Paul McCartney is kind of up there as not only a bass player, but a songwriter and a singer and someone who can do all those things at the same time, which is pretty admirable. I was never really a huge fan of the band Yes, but I loved Chris Squire's playing. I was a huge Allman Brothers fan, so I was really a big fan of Barry Oakley. In fact, my first bass rig was copied directly from what he used to play.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So those are three that pop to mind, but there are certainly a lot more.
Well, let me actually play you a clip of you. This is you actually doing an interview in 1993, just a year after Automatic for the People came out, and you're talking about this particular album.
It's amazing the amount of emphasis people put on the lead vocal. I know it is, you know, it's the part of the song that you really hear and everything. But because I did a couple on the last record, it's like, wow, there's all this. But, you know, I've been singing on it, all the records. You know, it's back there. It's just not lead vocals. So it just didn't work out that way. It's not something I worry about. You know, if there's a song that needs me to be the lead singer, I'll do it. But it's not something I really push for.
Do you still feel that? I mean, you must get to sing more now. Or do you still feel the way that it doesn't matter whether you're on lead or backup?
Well, everything is really in service of the song. Whatever your project, you want to do the thing that makes the song as fully realized as possible. Yeah, I do some fun stuff. I do some charity things now, charity music things with other bands that if we do an REM song, I'll sing the lead on it. And it's really fun. The one I love is a great fun song to sing, and I really enjoy it. But again, you know, I was in the band with one of the best rock and roll singers of all time. So what, you know, what, who am I going to push him out of the way and say, let me have that mic? No, I enjoyed my role in the band constantly. I love to sing. But I've always loved to sing harmonies and counter melodies and backups and things like that. Ever since I was a kid, that was kind of where my attention went when I listened to music on the radio. So it worked out nicely for me.
Let's hear a little bit more. This is Drive.
What if I ride? What if you walk? What if you rock around the clock? Tips, top, tips, top. What if you did? What if you walk? What if you try to get off?
What do you make of some of the arguments that go on recently in pop music? And the one I think of is, because REM was such an incredible live band, the musicianship of all the players was so high. What do you make of the argument over whether or not a pop musician should be able to recreate live the sound that listeners hear on the album? Do you think that's essential?
I don't think it's essential. I think it just depends on, you know, what you want, what you expect. I mean, today, it's funny, I hear young people sing, really young kids. I saw a girl sing the national anthem, and her voice sounded like it was being auto-tuned, but it wasn't. She had just learned to sing in a way that sounded like she was being auto-tuned. So, you know, music changes, music evolves. What people expect to hear certainly changes. You know, I prefer live music done by people that can really play. Then again, I love Kraftwerk, know. And so, it fortunately, there's room for all of this stuff in the musical spectrum.
So is there a larger or wider purpose for pop music, do you think? Or is it just making songs you like? Is there a deeper meaning to it?
Well, of course, I think there is. I mean, even in today's multimedia world, you know, music is the soundtrack to your life. When important things are happening to you as you grow and mature, you'll remember the songs you were listening to when those things happened, and that's probably always going to be the case. I hope so, anyway. You know, music can be a social change force, and certainly not like it used to be. Obviously, music did help change in the world. It did help change the world back in the 60s and 70s, but, you know, there are just so many other platforms for people to get information and put information out there now that it's been diluted a good bit. But sure, I think music can be whatever you want it to be. And if you want to make music that is going to try to change the world, then more power to you.
But, you know, and I wonder then how protective you are of REM's message and the things that REM stood for as a group. And I know that REM in at least one way got pulled into the debate over what songs can and cannot be used for political rallies. Do you feel protective of the band's legacy?
Oh, certainly we do. I mean, we will never, you know, license a song to a commercial enterprise just for pure commerciality. We do let our songs be used for certain political things or certain social movements, things like that. And, you know, when it comes to things like what Trump did and stuff like that, when people purchase a blanket license, they can play whatever they want. And I don't think we can legally stop people from doing that. We can just make a big stink about it and embarrass them if at all possible.
So let's hear one more clip of music. This is the Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight. So 25 years on, you're hearing these songs again, maybe more often than you have in a really long time. How do you feel about the album? I mean, where do you place it in your memory? How do you put it in context?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, since I get asked about it a lot, I tend to think that musically this is our strongest record from start to finish. I think that for a lot of reasons, none of which I can be absolutely sure of, but the fact that we knew we didn't have to tour, the fact that we could take our time with this, the fact that we were enjoying a little bit less pressure from having to tour and play so much, it just came together really well. We were having a good time writing the songs and making the songs, and I think it's just our most consistent record from start to finish, so I feel pretty good about that. But as I always tell people when they ask me, I love all my children equally.
Fair enough. Very diplomatic. That's Mike Mills, musician, bass player for Athens' own REM. Their record, Automatic for the People, gets a 25th anniversary re-release out on November 10th, and that doesn't seem that long to me, which probably just proves that I'm old. Mike, thank you.
You and me both.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, more about REM's Automatic for the People 25th anniversary. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Earlier, we spoke with REM bassist Mike Mills about the 25th anniversary of the group's album, Automatic for the People. We asked REM mega fan Jordan Stepp to share an appreciation of that album. She writes about the Athens music scene for the blog Athens Music Junkie, and she spoke with producer Sean Powers.
I first heard Automatic for the People when I was in middle school, and something about Automatic for the People just lives in your bones when you hear it as an album for the first time.
Smash, smash, crack, push, whack, tie another one to the racks, baby.
It's a deeply personal album for many people.
Rock and roll. Nobody tells you where to go, baby.
So you have life and death and mourning and joy and pain and sorrow.
What if I ride? What if you walk? What if you rock around the clock?
My favorite song off the album is the song Drive. It's an odd start to an album from a band that was traditionally known for punk-like rock and roll.
Hey, hey, kid, shake your leg. Maybe you're crazy in the head.
It is definitely one of those songs that you can take many interpretations of. It's my favorite song off the album because, unlike the rest of the album, Drive is one of the songs that keeps coming back to me. When I listen to Automatic for the People, different parts of it will resonate with me depending on which part of my life I'm in. If I'm feeling in a particularly melancholy mood, I'll listen to something like Sweetness Follows or Find the River. If I'm angry, I'll listen to Ignore Land. But Drive kind of fits the whole gamut of emotions for me. And it digs deep into my appreciation of specific guitar-driven melodic rock that REM does so well.
Hey, hey, kid, rock and roll. Nobody tells you where to go.
One of my favorite lyrics from it is just, "Hey, kids, rock and roll. Nobody tells you where to go." And it's trying to tap into the punk ethos of, we're gonna rock and roll, and you can like it or don't. We don't care. But it's quite a tune.
Maybe I tried to get off, baby.
A song from the album that I'd like to talk about is "Sweetness Follows."
ready and to bury your father and your mother. What did you think when you lost another? I used to wonder why did you bother. Distance from one to the other.
Sweetness Follows is definitely, in my opinion, the key to understanding the entirety of Automatic for the People. It's the middle of the album, and it's kind of the emotional heart of Automatic. It's very sad and mournful sounding. More than likely, everyone has their own interpretation of what Sweetness Follows means to them. For many, it's a straightforward tale of being estranged from parents or friends and regretting the interactions you may have had with them during life, and now that they've passed, you don't get to have those interactions. It's a quietly optimistic meditation on the nature of death and grieving, because the idea is sweetness does follow and you do get through the experience. It's not everyone's favorite on the album, but it's certainly a key point in the album that kind of brings together all of the themes from Automatic for the People. It's life and death and suffering and joy and friendship, and it's a very complete thought.
It's these little things they can pull you under. Live your life filled with joy. Yeah, yeah, we were all together, lost in our little lives.
Sweetness Follows may not be the most popular track on the album for multiple reasons, mostly because the album is jam-packed with amazing songs, and this track may have been a standout on any other album, but when compared with songs such as Drive or Man on the Moon, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But it's also a pretty forlorn-sounding track from the beginning, if you don't take the time to listen to it and appreciate the overall message it's trying to get through. Then it's easy to kind of write it off as a downer track. For me, there are some albums that you can put on in the background while you're doing dishes and kind of ignore, but Automatic for the People is an album that demands to be listened to as a whole. In a quiet space, it's something to be meditated on, and for me, it's something that you can't ignore.
That's Jordan Stepp with her appreciation of the REM album Automatic for the People. That album turns 25 this year. Finding your true calling can take years, even decades. Children's book author Christopher Paul Curtis found his calling in his 40s. After spending more than a decade working in a Detroit car factory, he began to write novels for children about the African-American experience. That love of writing helped him become the first African-American man to win the Newbery Medal. Christopher Paul Curtis is in Decatur tomorrow night. He spoke with my colleague, Adam Ragusa.
Tell everybody about your journey from where you were born to becoming a professional children's book author. It's not a common story.
Nope. On the way, I didn't see anybody there but me. I started out as working on the line at Fisher Body in Flint, Michigan. I did that for 13 years. I hated every single minute of it, but I found comfort in writing during my breaks. And I think that, you know, it's what I tell young people all the time. The more you do something, the better you get at it. So I think that all the practice writing I did while I was in the factory made a big difference. And when I quit the factory, I entered my books in contests and finally got the Watson's Go to Birmingham published. And then It's been all gravy since then.
What kinds of things were you writing when you were working on the line?
You know, I'd start out trying to write fiction, but I was a very good reader, and I knew bad fiction when I was reading it, so I could tell I was writing bad fiction. So I set the fiction aside, and I just wrote, really, I was journaling, probably, is what it would be called. I was writing about things that went on in the factory, things that were going on in my life, just trying to get my thoughts down.
And when did you turn to children's literature?
You know, I still, you know, I've got almost 10 books that are children's books, but I still don't feel like I'm a children's writer. Huh. When I started writing The Watsons Go to Birmingham, it was narrated by a 10-year-old boy, but I always thought of it as really an adult story. If I would have thought of who the audience was, I would have said it was adults, but that it was written in the voice of a 10-year-old boy. But then once I entered the contest and they told me it was a young adult book or even a middle reader, I kind of felt like you publish the book, you can call it whatever you want.
Sure. Well, remind everybody of the plot of The Watsons Go to Birmingham, and from that we'll segue into a clip of a movie that was made of it a few years ago.
Okay, The Watsons Go to Birmingham is narrated by 10-year-old Kenny Watson, and Kenny's got three problems in his life. The first problem is he's very smart. And that doesn't sound like it should be a problem, but it is. Kids call him Poindexter and Egghead, and he gets teased about things. The second problem that Kenny has is that he's got an older brother named Byron, and Byron has dedicated his life, according to Kenny, to making Kenny miserable. And the third problem that Kenny has is he has what's known as a lazy eye, and that just means the muscles on one of the sides of one of his eyes are stronger than they should be, and his eyes are crossed. In the story, Kenny is narrating about a trip that his family took. They were taking Byron from Flint, Michigan, down to Birmingham, Alabama. And working in the factory, many of the people that were there were from the South. And
sure.
When we get a break from the factory, like a week off or changeover, they would drive back South. And lots of times they would send, if they had a bad kid, they'd send it back to the grandmother back down home. So I kind of borrowed the story from that and decided to make the Watsons send the 13-year-old semi-juvenile delinquent son, Byron, down to Birmingham. And once they're down there, it touches upon the bombing of a church, much like the 16th Street Baptist Church. It's not a civil rights story. It's really a story about a family and the impact that this bombing has on them.
All right, let's listen to a clip of a movie that was made of the book in 2013.
I mean, I don't like leaving my family down here in the segregated South, not without me. But I don't have a choice. I got to go to work, and your mother wants to spend some time with her mother.
So what do you need from me?
I want you to think before you act, because your actions have real consequences down here.
We are talking to Christopher Paul Curtis. He is an author of fictional works that are described and marketed as children's books, but as we just heard, he often really feels like he's writing for a general audience. And nonetheless, he is a recipient of the Newbery Medal, which is the highest honor in children's literature. Writes a lot about the African-American experience, going back to his upbringing in Flint, Michigan. A lot of your books set in Flint or similar towns like Gary, Indiana. Your work is so strongly associated with the industrial North, places where African Americans during the Great Migration came from the South, went up to places like Flint to work in factories. And we have seen such a significant reversal of that demographic trend, the reverse Great Migration. America's black children, to a great extent these days, are being raised in the South, more so than in those traditional northern capitals of African-American life. I wonder if you plan to look to the South more for inspiration in your future work, or are you really Flint to the core?
No, well, I'm Flint to the core, but that doesn't mean I have to write only about Flint. My latest book, which is called The Journeys of Little Charlie, actually starts out in South Carolina and then comes up to Buxton, but the majority of the story takes place in the southern United States. And it's different also in that I've the narrator of the book is a white sharecropper, a 13-year-old boy. I do feel very much in touch with communities like Flint and Gary and Cleveland, Rust Belt cities. I think I know them, and you know I know the hard times that we're going through in these cities, and you know in many ways the people have been forgotten.
What do you see in the future for them?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. As I said, they seem to be forgotten. Politicians don't really care. What happens it seems like they don't care what happens to the people of Flint. And, you know, Flint is such a good example because we have the water that has poisoned so many people there. And, you know, there was a big kick up and kerfuffle about it for maybe a year. And now you don't hear all that much about it. And the water's still bad. So I don't know. I hate to sound pessimistic, but being realistic, we need some big changes before anything positive can be done, I think.
That's children's book author Christopher Paul Curtis speaking with Adam Ragusea. Curtis speaks at Holy Trinity Parish Episcopal Church tomorrow at 7 p.m. in Decatur. Details at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. We talked earlier with comedian Jim Gaffigan about what goes into his stand-up routine. Gaffigan's known for being a clean comic, and I wonder if that matters to you. Do you prefer a comic that doesn't swear all the time or talk about sex, or does that matter at all? You know how to reach us. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook and on Twitter. We're at OST Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.